Welcome to Business Second Opinion with Carol Sanford, a respected thought leader in the world of business design for growing people in order to grow your business. She always offers a contrarian view on what sacred temples of wisdom, such as the Harvard Business Review, advise. Her approach is based on living systems research and her four decades of practice with Fortune 500 companies and rockstar entrepreneurs. I'm Zach Swartout, and I'm your host. Today, Carol is giving a business second opinion on leadership development, specifically in an article entitled Why Leadership Development Fails and What to Do About It, from the October 2016 article of the Harvard Business Review by Michael Beer, Magnus Finstrom, and Derek Schrader. Welcome, Carol.
Hi, Zach.
So what are the premises or foundations of this article that these three authors are starting from as they're kind of taking a look at leadership development in organizations today?
Well, they start with an understanding of that right now on the planet, businesses spend about $365 billion a year on leadership development. And the follow-up studies that they do pretty universally show that there is no lasting effect after 1 year. I mean, where else would you throw away that kind of money? But they did some more digging to try and understand why they think that happens. And they have three premises in this article, which are pretty straightforward. And I pretty much agree. I think they're incomplete, but I pretty much agree that, you know, if you're dumping billions of dollars in, you should be expecting to see a payoff, and that the purpose should be to improve organizational effectiveness. The second premise that they hold, if you accept that first one, is that the real challenge is that the managerial and organizational systems, even after you've trained people, prevent them from being able to apply what they've learned. And that's no matter their level of intelligence, no matter how motivated they are, that a single, highly motivated, super smart individual who has been trained in something new has a very hard time being able to move anything when they go back because all of the systems of the way work is designed goes against them. So therefore, the third premise is that you have to create what they call a favorable context for learning and development. And in order to do that, you have to shift some of the organizational design and the way things are happening from the top and the bottom and in every unit. Now, I agree with that, and we can talk later about where I feel like that last one particularly is incomplete. But it is significant to know that there are a couple of assumptions built into that last one, which I think I'd like to share with you because it's a part of the premise they're operating with.
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. The training that they give people is based on a very old, archaic assumption about what you do, which is the organization is made up of individuals, so there must be individuals you need to train. And what they do is they begin to look at what it is that they feel like needs to be shifted in terms of the right set of knowledge and skills and attitudes for each of those individuals. And they define them into something that might be called competencies. And because competencies are individual, they can therefore design and select training, hire some people to do it if they need to, sell top management on that it should be done, and then they conduct the training based on the premise and the idea that if all of these individuals get this training, then the organization will have it, and therefore it ought to be able to move forward. So that's kind of the premise that this is based on.
Okay, got it. And so as you're looking at this, like, what are some concerns that you have here? And then how would you start to kind of look at it or reframe it a bit?
Well, there's several things. I'm going to offer you four premises that I operate off of, which I think fundamentally are different than what they're looking at. I think they found what you might call the problem, but the premise they have for how to work on it are pretty limited. I believe that you need to start, if you're going to redesign something, with first principles of how humans and living systems and the intelligence of those work. And I don't believe they're doing that. I believe they're starting with the problem they've got and doing what I call building a meal ameliorating practices. So we'll make it a little less bad by what we do. So here's where I believe we might start and that are based on how humans work more completely. I believe that you have to work simultaneously on developing the material and the work that you're working on and the development of the person who is going to be working. So right now, the way training is done is not what I'd call developmental. It's called segmented. So you do training and then people go back and apply it to work. And usually they use more hypothetical situations, which are used across the entire organization, rather than having people learn a new way to do something like strategic planning or like leadership that they're going to work on. And they have to learn it in a new way and they have to work on themselves while they're learning and they're working on applying it. They're designing where they're going to go put it. The idea that we would do what I call actualize and potentialize separately has come out of the way our school systems operate, where you study for years and years and years, maybe all the way through a PhD, and then in theory, you only do a little learning off and on the rest of your life, and you go apply it. Well, that's actually not the way human beings work very well, or organizations. So my first premise is that you have really got to be capability building, which I mean critical systems thinking, personal and group ability to work together while you actually work on something real that you're about to carry out. Now, the reason for that is my second premise is that you have to destabilize current patterns and make them integral with the way work is happening, which creates, this is going to sound very strange, but you create a conscious shock to the system. I'm trying to learn something new and I'm applying it to something that's urgent. It has to be done immediately, as we said. That will destabilize the way I normally work. That destabilization process is important to a human in the way neural networks get built to cause it to form a whole different cellular structural and network structure. So all of the work that I do, I make sure that if I actually want it to be integrated, absorbed, well, absorbed is not quite the right word because it's more choiceful than just taking it in. You have to do quite a bit of destabilization. Anyone who's been around me will know that people not only expect that, but they kind of count on it as a way to help them learn. The third premise I'm working with here is that you have created a culture by how you've been doing things. So you've been telling people by the way you've worked, training, coaching, all that is separate from doing work. It doesn't happen simultaneously. You're going to change the culture by how you do this. And by everything you do, how you're doing it is producing a way people think. So you have to examine that. There's one fun little piece of theory here I think people might enjoy. I had a very early teacher named James V. Clark. He was at Harvard during a decade and a little more study that was done cross-disciplinarily with education, psychology, and business. And they discovered that in order for people to really change, and I thought it was funny they did the research here 1 year later to see if it stuck. They'd done nothing in between. But what they found at Harvard, and it was the foundation of AA, the way it got founded, the foundation of many of the halfway houses to reverse recidivism, language learning. There were many, many things they studied. And the first one was that you have to have a frequency of learning something new weekly. You can't wait and then come back and do something in a few months, if at all, or a year later. You have to have this frequency shifting. Secondly, you have to do it about 10% of your waking hours on the new behavior. You have to pay attention to it. So there's a certain kind of intensity that has to happen weekly. And third, it takes about 3 to 8 years to shift core patterns. That's why I make a contract with my clients. We don't start unless we're going to work at least 3 years, and then we see, and they know by then. Plus, you need to work on the whole human being, and you need to have people who have some experience. So I don't see that in what they're talking about here, so I thought I better start with my premise. Did those make sense to you, Zach?
Yeah, they totally did. And I actually want to dig into this in our conversation here around their approach, their six basic step approach to talent development. And I want to start with kind of the first two here and see how far we get. But essentially, they're advocating for this kind of linear process. And so the first one is the senior team clearly defines values and an inspiring strategic direction as the way of kind of beginning to do leadership development in a more integrated way. So can you kind of dig into this one with me a little bit and help me to understand thinking here?
Yeah, so I tend to not create executive teams that you start the change with because that's culturally defining something as hierarchically determined. I create what are called core teams. And those core teams come together and they are doing strategic thinking. They are a mix of the entire organization, people who are highly respected, who love taking on change. It has many of the fiduciary responsible leaders because they have to approve sometimes things happening because you're going to work on real strategy. But again, as I said, you're going to do it in a disruptive way. You're going to learn a new way to think about it. So I don't start with a senior team and I don't ever spend any time dividing values. I've never quite understood where that comes from because they tend to be artificial. They get plastered on walls. They get shellacked and then people ignore them, or sometimes they put them in cards in their wallets. What I want are people defining who the business is uniquely, what it is that the global imperatives are, the world you're in and what you care about, where those need to be worked and you can affect. So you can tell these are decisions about application. They have values embedded in them, but I don't ask people to articulate those. And then you create a corporate direction. That, to me, there's a whole bunch of destabilization in there with the new way to do it being introduced while you do it with teams of people, which are a mix of the organization and then expected to execute on it. So that's what I think about the first one.
Okay, got it. And so just to clarify, so it sounds like a core team is made up of folks from all over the organization that is not just made up of kind of senior leadership. It's literally kind of, yeah, maybe you can shed a light on that a little bit.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Because you really want strategy to emerge from the body of the whole. That's what corporate means, corporate direction, you want the body of the whole. And you don't want it to be thought about as something only the top people are smart enough to do, because then it gets handed off down in a delegation way, which to me is another practice that creates a culture, which is not what you want if you're trying to create change.
Got it. Okay. And so the second one that they offer here is step two, just follow these six steps and you get right there. So after gathering candid, anonymous observations and insights from managers and employees, the team diagnoses barriers to strategy, execution, and learning. Whew. It then redesigns the organization's roles, responsibilities, and relationships to overcome those barriers and motivate change. So help me here, Carol.
All that sounds so simple, right? All right. We got this inspiring and value set. We should just be able to redefine everything. First, I don't believe in anything being done anonymously. I think that that allows people to avoid learning how to have conversations that are using what, you know, I call framework thinking and the ability to be self-managing in regard to their conversations. If you've got an organization that you have to do something anonymously, you are in deep trouble, because it means the politics have taken over. So I, first, don't do anything anonymously. Secondly, I don't do surveys, because surveys leave people giving you what they think about current existence and what they think they ought to do to improve it. And anytime you start with existence, you're in trouble, instead of starting with the strategy and starting with the uniqueness and distinctiveness. And you can't have people know what that is because you're anonymously interviewing them. My experience with how it is you start to do all the things they just described is you need to do more of a flow. You need to do the redesign of some of the processes, but you do that again while you're starting to implement them. You don't sit in with a group and you redesign all that in a few weeks or even a few months. You're actually rebuilding an organization. I say five phases you have to go through. You do have to get strategy with this disruptive way. You have to do culture, and then you do processes. That takes quite a while to start changing how people engage. Then systems, which is all the systems that you use for pay and progression, keeping track of audit and evaluate, and then finally structure. So what they're talking about here first lumped way too much together, and it did it without building capability. And as I pointed out, one of my premises, developmental. Learn a new way to do it while you implement it and stretch it out over a period of time, because that's what it takes for it to be internalized.
We'll be right back. I want to remind everyone about how to participate in the show by joining in our quiz on SurveyMonkey each week. This is where you can offer articles for review from HBR or other popular business written media. Find the link at www.businesssecondopinion.com. It's more fun to listen when you participate. To get educated about Carol's approach to critiquing popular ideas, you can also download her chapter at www.businesssecondopinion.com. Plus, there's a weekly drawing for a free copy of Carol's new book, The Regenerative Business, for all those who participate in the quiz, write comments, or article recommendations. So as I was thinking about these six steps, and I was thinking about kind of digging into some questions, I kind of just want to do the other four, because it feels like there's a lot here for us to dig into. So if that's okay, I just want to wrap up this list of six and then kind of see what's after that, if that's okay.
Of course. I love to talk about these things.
Okay, great. So number three on their list in the six steps to leadership perfection is day-to-day coaching and process consultation helps people to become more effective in that new design. So I'm sure you have an opinion on coaching and process consultation. So help me to see that here, if you could.
You bet I do. There are a couple of things about this particular idea about how to go forward, which is it's still stuck a bit with the assumption they made about individuals or what you have to work with. And that if you could train the individuals, now they're saying if you could coach the individuals and do a consultation, and even if you did them in small groups, what you're doing is someone is the expert who is supposedly coaching them. So first, I am not a fan of coaching because it's not a process of developing human beings. It tends to be working with some fixed set of competencies and way of working. I can't even see how they would change that. But secondly, the individual process is the slowest there is. I only work in what I call fishbowls. So I don't work with individuals. No one can hire me to coach or mentor them. And I, of course, discourage everybody who's around me from doing that. And the reason is that if you put a single individual in a fishbowl with everybody who is in the group, and you work on what they're trying to work on in a way that you're bringing a resourcing experience to it, not a coaching one, not I'm the expert and I can tell you what to do, but I can ask you questions. I can provide you a framework to think through it. And that process of you sitting in the middle of the room first builds your ability to manage your state in the face of someone asking you questions. There's no way you have an answer to, and you have teammates watching and watching you sweat while you're doing it. That process is working on development. It's working on the conscious shock, the destabilization, but you're only working on, there's nothing hypothetical. It is only on something that really needs to be moved forward for the business. So that process of moving away from coaching and consulting has the ability to keep an organization alive, slightly destabilized, and not focused on the individuals, but on teams learning. And you get kind of a quantum magnitude of speed of change when you do that.
Okay, got it. So step number four sounds almost like a recipe. I mean, this totally is a recipe, but it says the organization adds training where needed. So add more salt, I guess, is kind of what they're saying here. But help me to see how salt might also lead us astray.
Well, what I really think one needs to do is move away from training, because training is always for individuals. It's rarely with natural work teams. And it's, as far as I know, I've never seen it where it was tied to real work a group needed to do, except maybe as an example you worked on. What I like to do is shift the roles that people have had called supervisor and sometimes manager, and you have them instead become resources to natural work teams. And sometimes they have special expertise, so they go across multiple teams, but they're no longer making the decisions and delegating to teams. They're actually building capacity of teams to be self-managing. But I'm not a fan of getting rid of supervisors because there's too much wisdom and experience to draw on there. It grows them as individuals to think about being a resource. Now, that what I mean by that word is it returns people to themselves as the source. So in Greece, we did this. We took all the supervisors who for years in the Colgate-Palmolive factory, it was one of the first times I did this many years ago, and we said, all right, you're just changing role. You're no longer delegating. What you're doing is people are coming to you, not for coaching. You're not going to teach them what you know, but you're going to work on them on critical thinking skills, on personal development, how you're applying all these new ways of working, the new framework thinking. That process is so destabilizing to the supervisor and to the team. But it, again, the minute you destabilize something, you have a chance of it moving more rapidly, and you have built into it lots of reflection so people can see how they're doing.
Got it. So number five is success in changing behavior is gauged using new metrics for individual and organizational performance. What do you got here?
I only am a fan of metrics in one place, and that is in the output side of our customers' innovation. So the minute we work internally, which is where most metrics are placed, we're going to count how many we've done or something, or how far we've gone, or how much percentage increase or decrease we've done. It makes us internally focused. So I really believe that if you want to shift the entire organization, shift how things are led, then what you want to do is shift what you measure. For example, I don't know whether I've told you this example before, but in DuPont, instead of measuring the yarn output and yield, we moved into measuring how well the seatbelt fabric sheet did, because that's what it was the customers went measuring. Now, you can do an actual metric on that because they have metrics they are measuring to make sure it works. So The idea of any internal metrics, I think, undermines the kind of culture that organizations are moving toward and not what you want leadership being developed around. You want to have people becoming increasingly self-reflective and doing it against what I call promises beyond ableness, bigger things they're taking on than what they normally would do. Those you can measure, but you don't count them. And once you can measure them, you can measure them relative to what you're producing for a client or a stakeholder, for Earth, for communities. And now what you do is bring in meaning, which is what really builds productivity. And that's why people mostly do metrics, because they don't know any other way to do it.
So the last one they use here is systems for selecting, evaluating, and developing and promoting talent are adjusted to reflect and sustain the changes in organizational behavior. So what are your thoughts around this last one?
I think if I go back to something I said earlier, it would help speak to this, which is you really need to be working on developing people relative to and building organizational. So there's this combined, you have to develop people and you have to build a context for them to work in. You have to build work design they can work in. But you have to have principles off of which you're doing that, or you do it off of ameliorating something that isn't working very well. So the thing that you have to go back to for developing human beings, and not training, but development, is are we augmenting their internal locus of control, their ability to take responsibility and with no excuses, no victimhood. And most of the structures and things we create work against that. Are we building their capacity for external considering, actually experiencing the quality that the lives of their customers, consumers, even Earth, the suppliers, can we have them start to experience that and be considering of that in what they do? And can we build their personal agency so they act independently for the good of all of the stakeholders, including the business? And if we build off of that, then you're going to be not needing a lot of fill-in kinds of things, because you will have all of the work systems you have, all of the promotion systems, anything you have internally will be designed to foster those three things.
And so do you have anything that you would want to add to this in terms of your approach, say like a 6+1 here or something else that comes to mind in terms of an approach?
Well, I've been hinting at one all the way along, so thanks for the question. In my new book, I write about 30 toxic practices. I have, over the 4 decades I've been working, accumulated in first in file folders and other things about the things that are really toxic. And I ended up with over 100 of them. But I said, what are the most toxic thing to organizations working, to leaders being able to lead organizations at work? And I put those down, and you've been hearing me speak to a few of them. I mean, one of those things is that hierarchies that operate in a way that they delegate continuously came about in 600 or more years ago with kings, queens, and a hierarchical church. We are still dragging that stuff around with us. If you really want to have leadership development work and human beings be able to change and evolve and contribute, you have to stop doing some things. You have to get rid of the toxic practices of incentives, rewards, recognition, surveys, everything that creates a third-party, externally determined process of somebody else deciding where you fit. So the thing they don't have in this article is the reason so much of what organizations try and do in developing their leaders doesn't work is because they send them back into toxic practices in addition to the work design isn't very whole.
Thank you so much for helping us to see this with new eyes today, Carol. I really appreciate your time.
My pleasure.
Do you want to suggest articles for Carol to review, pose questions for her to answer, or even argue with her response and get a second opinion? Become a member at www.businesssecondopinion.com. Subscribe and review this podcast and get involved in a free drawing to win a copy of the book or a poster of our readers' favorite quotes from the book. Also, subscribe to the blog that accompanies the podcast and newsletter that keeps you up to speed on what's coming next. Join us next Thursday for a Harvard Business Review article entitled Forming Stronger Bonds with People at Work, an article all about emotional intelligence. Business Second Opinion is edited, mixed, and mastered by ResonateRecordings.com. If you have a podcast or want to start a podcast, you can go to ResonateRecordings.com to get your first episode produced for free. This has been Business Second Opinion.